Hello, and welcome to Required Reading, the podcast that revisits the most impactful books from our childhood. My name is Erin Bowles. I am an actor, writer, and I keep forgetting that I do qualify as a podcaster. Our guest today is Zoe Dennis. She is a creative executive on the feature side of FICO Entertainment. In addition to her work in film, she is also a producer of the award-winning podcast Funny 'Cause It's True with Elise Myers through Paul Feig and Laura Fisher's Powder Keg Media. She got her start in the industry in the Lionsgate mailroom, which basically she means like really great at admin work. Prior to landing in LA, she spent a year in Chicago as part of the inaugural class of the Harold Ramis Film School at the Second City. Before that, she studied at the Gallatin School of Individualized Studies through NYU while simultaneously working at the Magnet Theater and getting to be a fly on the wall of the New York comedy scene. Welcome, Zoe.
Oh, it's so funny hearing it out loud.
Well, today's episode is The Bell Jar by Sylvia Plath.
Yes.
It's from 1963. I just want to put out a blanket trigger warning because it's a dark one. We're dealing with suicide, sexual assault, mental health in general. So take care. How did this book first come into your life? Like, what's your relationship with it?
I meant to look it up. I was some advanced English class that I was in high school, and I want to say it was my sophomore year. So probably, how old are you as a sophomore? Like 15, 16.
I think so, yeah.
Which is funny because I, as I like was doing a, after I finished rereading it and Google searching, it was like one of the questions is like, can a 13-year-old read this? And the answer was like, well, Rose, because I guess the person was there, Rose, like, seems like it's some heavy material, so it should be 15 and up. And I'm like, I still think 15 is like too impressionable of an age to read it at, as I
Yeah.
clearly it's been in my brain since I read it in high school.
I'm really excited to dive into how things felt reading it at that age because I read it at I think 19, and I know it would have been such a radically different experience if I had read it in high school.
Yeah.
And I think one of the biggest things about this book is just how deeply relatable it all feels, which is also scary and dark. But I'm so glad I reread it because it really like did not save in my brain the first time I read it.
Well, that's how it felt for me too as I was reading, because I was like, for years I would be like, The Bell Jar is my favorite book. And then, like, I was when you brought up this podcast, and I was like, oh, The Bell Jar, obviously. And then I was sitting and thinking, like, I have just like little tiny snapshots of what I remember happening in it. But like, it was almost like I was talking to my therapist about this yesterday, because I was sitting next to me, next to my Zoom. But it's almost as if I read it and I identified too much with it. And my brain was like, we're gonna slide that into a drawer. And we're not going to really remember why we've identified with this, but we'll just know the vibes of it and like hang on to it.
Had you only read it the one time, do you think, before this?
Yeah, I only read it in school, and then I was even thinking about how what kind of student I was, and I was like, did I even read the full thing, or was this like the one that I fully read and like everything else? Because I was like such a bad student of like I would read just enough to be confident about it, and then be like, I never finished that book. I have like a shelf full of books from college and high school that I'm like, I didn't actually read those books. I read like 5 pages out of it.
Yeah.
But
And you said it was during an English class. Like
yeah.
how like I'm so curious as to it makes sense why it was not taught at my high school.
Yeah.
Because like I don't know an actual statistic, but I feel like our high school had an exceptional number of mental health problems in students. But how was it taught? Like what was the conversation about it? Was it like a deep sit down? Was it a worksheet and a pop quiz? Like
It was like if I remember correctly, it was definitely like an analysis of it, and like I'm sure we probably tied it in with some of her poetry and did probably a poetry portion as well. But yeah, I'm like trying to remember the context of like what other books that year it was taught with. But it's also just a murky pile in my brain at this point. I like feel like this might be the same year that I read Frankenstein for the first time, which is also an impactful one, just because of the, I was like, this is existentialism. Oh, great. I understand it completely, like kind of
Yeah.
thing. So yeah, no, we definitely just like, I think we dissected it and just went through it, but that's kind of a non-answer of like, I don't really remember what the
That's
actual
okay.
conversation around it was.
And I think you sort of answered this, but like, what was your conception like of Sylvia Plath? Like, to me, reading it, I had such a constant thought about like the character of the real person and our like understanding and memory of her. I have her so heavily associated with like Tumblr in 2014, and
Funny.
I don't even know how to phrase it. Like, I guess, what did you know about her then? And then did she play like, I think this book can sometimes be an identity.
Yeah.
Do you think it did that for you?
I don't th I think I was too much of an like a wallflower to really claim an identity around anything, but like so it was one of those like I like secretly was like, oh, this is I
Yeah.
like completely understand this. And like I like her as like a figure in my brain was just kind of like, oh, like I just remember knowing the fact that she killed herself with her oven and I was like fascinating. But the like beyond that, and it's funny hearing about Tumblr. It's like I wasn't in a Tumblr era, but I think I was just not in that section of it of like, but it makes sense that it would be such a strong personality on Tumblr. But it's so interesting revisiting it like 15 years later, essentially, and like I don't know, I'm like staring at her image as what
Yeah.
I'm like looking down at. It's like I'm looking down at the little image and she just looks so young in it. And it's just wild, but
Yeah, you had mentioned this in a text, but I didn't look it up how old she was when she died. She was 30. Okay.
she was
She was
30,
30.
which is so some fun added context for all this. So it's like she killed herself on February 11th, 1963. My birthday is February 12th, and when I like reminded myself of that fact, I was like, that must have been also a connection point that I was like, this is crazy. And I just because I completely forgot, like I said, put it in a drawer, shut that drawer in my brain, and just forgot what most of like her and everything as well. It's just like, I was like, oh, first she killed herself at 30. And then for us to be doing this like on the cusp of me turning 30 and me in such a better place and have like my own mental health completely managed at this point. I mean, completely managed in the only way mental health can be completely
Yeah.
managed, but having it managed in such a different space and thinking how it's almost like, when I read this the first time was like the beginning of understanding of like, oh, some of these thoughts I have in my head are like a shared experience. It's not just like, oh, I have this thought and like I don't see it in anyone else. No one else is talking about it. And now doing the like bookend of rereading it and being like, yep, like just check mark
Yeah.
while reading it. And it's like, yeah, it is. We are just in a bell jar. That is essentially what it feels like. But that connection point of just like the age being around the similar age, and like I was there's on in my copy, which is actually the copy that I've had from high school.
Yeah, that was what mine was.
It has like a whole thing in the back that's like it goes through her life a little bit more, and it's just like interesting to read how her 20s were like struggling with like professionalism of like professional creativity, and getting stuff published, and then the whole, oh man, I could go on a diatribe about motherhood as well, because as I was
Yeah.
reading, I was like, I almost texted someone after I finished reading it and being like, rereading this is like, oh, this is a stem of why I'm so ingrained in like my thought process about this kind of thing, or this was how I approached it. There's so many quotes within it, and I'm like, yes, this just like seeped into my personality, and I just never realized it and wouldn't be able to pinpoint it until now revisiting it. But yeah.
Wow. I like have a mini biography of her from Wikipedia, but I'd love to know what that also said. So I guess it's a good time to jump into who she is. I was amazed. I like clocked it a little bit when I was re or before I reread it and was researching. It is alarming to see how autobiographical it is, to the point where like that's gonna be a huge. That's so much of what I can think about it is about the yeah again like the character of the author and the reality of it. And her father died, I believe, when she was 8 years old, and the same year she publishes her first poem. After her third year at Smith College, she is awarded a position as a guest editor at Mademoiselle Magazine and spends a month in New York. She has an issue with the editor of the magazine concerning Dylan Thomas. I think it's something like she wanted to meet him and the editor knew, and then the editor met him without her. I don't, it doesn't quite matter. But she cuts herself and then gets ECT and then attempts suicide by crawling under the front porch of her parents' or her mother's house and taking sleeping pills, which is almost identical to how it happens in the book. That's 1953. She spends the next 6 months in psychiatric care, receiving electric and insulin shock treatment. And I'm not sure where they are, but I took a few notes on what that is. I'll find them. And her stay at the hospital was paid for by the same person who paid her Smith scholarship, which is Olive Higgins Prouty, who wrote Stella Dallas and Now Voyager, which are two huge classic Hollywood movies. She like badgered the doctor about how poorly he managed her ECT treatment. She finishes her bachelor's, gets her master's, I think, or at least goes to Cambridge. She meets Ted Hughes. He's a poet. She is impressed by his writing ahead of time. They start dating, they get married. She said, "We kept writing poems to each other. Then it just grew out of that, I guess, a feeling that we both were writing so much and having such a fine time doing it. We decided that this should keep on," which I'm so excited to talk about further. She has her daughter in 1960 and her first collection of poetry published the same year. 1961, she has a miscarriage. This is a trigger warning for domestic violence. In a letter to her therapist, she wrote that it was her husband beat her 2 days before the miscarriage. She finished the Bell Jar in 1961. The next year, her son is born. She has a car accident that is described as a suicide attempt. She finds out her husband is cheating on her. They separate. She has this big burst of creativity. She writes most of what would be in Ariel, her like biggest poetry collection. And The Bell Jar is published a month before her death. It's under a pen name, Victoria Lucas. And the critics, I think, were mostly indifferent. It's published in 1963 in the UK, but her mother blocks publication, so it's not published in the US until 1971. I felt like that was so much longer than I remember. It's important.
It is because it's like, I mean, like, I don't think this was, a point of discussion when I was first studying it, but now in the era we are with fiction, it's the original auto fiction.
Exactly.
Like,
Yeah.
it's just like now we're in a deluge of auto fiction being a huge subgenre of it, and it's like it feels reading it now is so familiar with everything else that's currently out there. But yeah, I do think it's like the foreword of the copy that I had talks heavily about the publication of it in the United States, of how
Oh, good.
it like slipped over to the United States, and it was took a lot of people on the UK side that were like, it's against, because it was all right after her death, and so it was like it's against, her wishes, or I think it was like, I think she promised her mom it would never be published under her name while her mom was alive, or either she promised it or like her estate promised it. I think Ted Hughes may have done it, I'm not sure, but her estate or someone made the promise that it wouldn't be published while her mom was still alive, because it's so, obviously it's so
Yeah.
directly about that relationship with her mother. And so then that's why she her mom was like heavily blocking it. But then it just got to a point where it was like they were probably going to do it against the wishes of all
Right.
those folks anyway, because capitalism. But
Yeah.
it's funny that it's like the car accident as a suicide attempt is not in the little like perennial classics summary of her life
Yeah.
or the domestic violence stuff. But yeah, did you know, I like want to confirm this fact too.
Yeah.
Let's just do a series of, I heard this and have it
Yeah.
recorded and shared into the world. Someone listening will be like, that's not accurate, just Google. But the Ted Hughes, his second wife also killed herself with an oven.
Oh, I don't know. It sounds familiar, but I can't say for sure.
Ignore the typing sound, but Ted Hughes' second
Yeah.
wife death. I swear that
Something spooky.
it was like, because it's even reading the book, when he it was on March 23rd, 1969, Weevil killed herself and her 4-year-old Shura in the London in their London home. Weevil followed Plath and utilizing the gas supply from an unlit oven. She turned the oven on but didn't light it, put sleeping pills in a glass of water, consuming half herself and giving half to her 4-year-old daughter, and then they both went to sleep. Imagine being Ted Hughes. Like
Yeah.
almost like she calls it in the book too, with Buddy saying, like, do I just drive women to like attempt? It's just like,
Yeah. That's a scene I adore. And such a, she just laughs, and I feel like it's not like a breaking point, but it's a snapping point, I think, for that
yeah,
character. So like in a good way, something snaps into place.
it
But
definitely is. Yeah, it's just like I was like, I learned that Ted Hughes fact before I finished reading the book, and then when I read that scene again, I was just like, oh, wow, she totally just was like, knew that this influence, even though it's not, I know that Buddy's probably not the Ted Hughes model in this because it's pre-meeting him, but it's still a weird connection.
yeah, and again, I think like the big question for me is like, how much is her and how much is her writing Esther? And so whether or not like there was a Buddy specifically, or he's an amalgamation, it, yeah, looking at you, Ted, I don't know.
Probably relived that scene after the second wife killed herself the same way. It's probably like asking, what do I drive women
You would
crazy?
hope so. Yeah. Especially then, because if it was in like 69, it's like my dead wife predicted this 7 years ago.
Yeah.
Rough. But I feel like so much of just knowing her biography, even the most bare bones facts of it, I feel like you are not, at least the way I received the book was through this understanding of like, you receive the book and then someone also tells you like, oh, you know, Sylvia Plath also killed herself and that this is supposed to be based on her. So I feel like the entire time, and going into this, a huge lens of mine was I have heard, and I guess I'm on like book talk and things like that, and I've heard so many people be like, oh, Sylvia Plath is actually bad. She's actually a bad person. She's like racist. And I was like, okay, let me actually look into that just beforehand. And it seems there's some really bad moments in this book. Like, I think the only character of color that does appear is the orderly who serves food, and her character kicks him. And there's just like derogatory remarks about other races. And it's apparently not, this is not the only time it appears in her portfolio. And I think the question that kept coming to me is like, the book is obviously written from Esther's perspective, it is in her voice, it is maybe like in her mind being dictated, that doesn't really matter. But how much of this is Plath creating a character of Esther who is unlikable and very rough around the edges, which I love, but I would not love being around Esther, no matter how much I identify with her, because she's just a very mean person. But how much of that is a purposely written character, and how much is Plath just writing herself?
How much is character and how much is just exactly how she felt. I think that like it's probably the percentage probably skews more into the higher percent of it being just her, especially if she's recreating such a specific time in her life. However, the embellished stuff, it seems a little bit more obvious on the embellishments of, with like the time in New York and leading up to that point kind of thing. But being within the I would have to assume that being within the actual asylum is probably a pretty direct, like, recounting to a certain extent. Because it has to, I mean, like, a part of her mother's reasoning was of blocking it was that, like, all the characters in the book are just thin caricatures of real people. So, like, it would just hurt people all over again to, like, have to relive that summer. So, if she knows, like, the extent of the novel, I would assume then that gives more validation that it was probably more really Plath's identity guised as Esther.
Yeah, I agree. I think, like you said, it's so specific. It's to her experiences and the ways that she renders these people are not kind. They are
No.
so they're incredibly precise. Like I can't, it is an incredibly well-written text, like indisputably the syntax, the language is just gorgeous, but it is so like hurt people. It's such a dark place to be in, but I think you touched on this a little bit earlier, like so many people are experiencing it, and it is also extremely isolating.
Yeah, it is. There's part of the foreword as well was talking about how like part of the reception once it came to the US and like in the reception in decades to follow is that it was just like the first time that the side of femininity was explored in text. So it's like, and it, goes against the grain of like child rearing in a certain extent. Like there is a whole, oh, I didn't write it down. There's a, the whole thing where she talks about like if I have to raise a child, like that's like too much kind of thing, or just like the thought of keeping a child alive. And that's like goes directly against everything that women are fed from childhood of like you're gonna take care of a kid at some point in your life. And like clearly Plath didn't want to ever do that, but then did have kids. And it was so shortly into those children's lives that like she ended it. It's interesting to just like, and I think it's, I guess it is necessary because I was thinking after I finished it, and as I mentioned earlier, the like how old you should be when you read it. I'm like, this is so heavy to like read in high school or like at a young age. But it also, despite it being heavy, I think is almost necessary because it's like, and I mean nowadays there's probably a bunch of texts of that you could read that feel that goes against the traditional experience expected of women. But like this is, such a foray into like you don't necessarily have to go down the traditional path, or like going down the untraditional is hard. Like doesn't, but that doesn't mean that the traditional path is the one that's like the one you need to take, and then it'll be easier because that'll have its own issues and nightmares and kind of thing. So yeah, it's pretty hefty.
There's her dealing with such an disillusionment and how hard things are that I feel like can often serve in that isolation aspect of like preparation somehow, but also is saying you're not alone, that it's like prophylactic feels wrong. But I did an episode on Catcher in the Rye a couple of months ago, and it feels like such a perfect pair for this, about just this constant disillusionment of everything is bad in her experience. I mean, she even the great, amazing stuff of getting this position in New York, she feels nothing. It's how the whole book starts. Not only is everything awful, but everyone has been lying to you so that your understanding of the world is, and it's just realizing again and again and again how false it is because of how much everything hurts. Because it's just, she's not set up for, as a character, her life is not set up for success. And the it's a hard inner world and a hard outer world for her to deal with.
Yeah, it's like, the scenes early in the book of like going to all those like formal lunches and stuff like that, and going to that and being like, oh wow, this is the expectations. And then having the one character, I'm blanking on her name, but the character that breaks the mold a little bit and goes with her to the bar with the guy.
I think that's Doreen,
That's Doreen. Yeah.
if
So
that's helpful.
Doreen's like alternative experience seeing with that, and her trying that and still being like, well, that's like, though, I mean, now thinking about it, it's like those are the two examples of like there's a traditional, you go to all these events and be a proper lady in secretarial school in the time, or the alternative, go hang out with the guy in Coney Island when you're supposed to be doing other stuff. And she doesn't choose either. She's so in between of like nothing is appealing. But it's like when you are in those phases or episodes, it is such an overwhelming feeling of just like nothing seems interesting. And then having to, there are so many moments in it too where she's like, oh, I gave the cursory, like, I wonder if they noticed that I was just going like, my gosh, like during that. And I'm like, yeah, I've definitely, like, I've had moments of those where it's like, I don't think this person realizes that I feel literally nothing to anything that they're saying at the moment. And like,
Right.
I am like, everything I'm saying is like, I can feel the mask on my face slipping a little bit, but like, I can't tell if they can tell that the mask is like falling down a little bit. Let me just adjust it and put it back up. So it's just like, it's just such an interesting entry point into like understanding those feelings or self-identifying. Like, you may not like self-identify with the entirety of the character, but like self-identifying with different moments within that can be such a thought starter. Because I think that's why it was so impactful for me. It was just like, I may not have identified fully with the character, though it does not help that the character is 5'10" and I am also 5'11", 5'10" three quarters, whichever you want to call it.
And I think
But
you can also like identify with the experiences even
yeah.
more than the character even. I think that's
Yeah, the
the
experiences are being in those positions and like, but like when you identify with them, it can cause you, like for me, I think, you know, looking back, I think it caused me to be like, oh, well, why do I feel that way? Or what does that mean if I like, if I identify with this, oh, I'm having a conversation with someone and all I can contribute is like my and gosh, like what does that fully mean? And it can cause you to dive deeper into yourself. I would say for the better, and I don't think there really is for the worse, because I think it would be for the better in general to just understand
Yeah,
yourself more.
absolutely. You know, as a person with mental illness, I've often like feel like everyone who is depressed who goes to film school tries to write something about what it is like to be depressed because it's so much easier to try to experience it by externalizing it and writing it down. And the constant issue that I came up with when I was in those ages is that depression is not very often the extremely sad, it's the extreme lack and the flatness and the vacancy, and that is really not interesting on screen and really hard to make more than a single photograph out of, you know? And I think that is such an incredible accomplishment in her writing of just of literally going through the motions, like you were saying, and how heavy that weighs. It like a physical weight on you.
Like I'm thinking like I'm sure there's been an adaptation of this, and I don't know if I want to watch it because
Yes.
like I want to keep the image in my own brain, but like the like nothingness of like there's that one scene where the new patient who's mute like comes into the asylum and she's like, I just go and I sit with her, and I'm like, so then you're just like mentally thinking out that scene, like it's just two people just like sitting there, just neither looking at each other or just looking at opposite directions, but they have no con, I mean the only commonality they have between them is their situation that they're in. But like, yeah, I thought that was interesting too, that she was like wanted to be the one to like get this person to talk, because she wanted like it would be almost like a moment of valor for her.
I think the characterization is so specific in the in that she would do that in I don't know. I think Esther Greenwood is an iconic character of sorts. She's so sharply rendered.
I agree. And I think that it's interesting the depictions of lucidity, I would say, for lack, or maybe that's the right word. The lucidity of like, oh, maybe it's like I'm not so trapped in it, and like that skiing scene where she's just like going so fast. And it's also, this is, it's like such a bizarre time to read this book because I just went skiing for the very first time, and there is a moment when you're just like going down the hill, just like, I'm just, this is all, this is what I'm doing, this is all I'm doing, and like you're just focusing on like the snow in front of you. And so her depiction of like everything melting away and she was just exhilarated by it, it's just like, oh yeah, there are those moments of lucidity when you are in those episodes or fogs that is like, everything's not so bad, and then it's like, nope, it comes quickly crashing back of like everything feels bad.
And I think that I mean this is really jumping straight to the end, but it's she talks about the metaphor of the bell jar and one of the last pages is like things are better now. This is not the exact quote. Things are better now, but it's still hovering there. It's and God, yeah.
It's like that quote or section is, it is very like, it's very real, because like, you know, the book ends with her being evaluated by those doctors again, so that could be released, and you just don't know. Like, I mean, clearly the real story is that she was released, and in this little bio that this book I have pointed to was like she like basically like called it of like you don't know like you could be some you could be in Europe, you could be like at home, like it could it just will like it could come back, it will come back almost, it's like
Yeah.
inevitable. And I think that's like as sad as it is of knowing the reality of Plath and how the book ends and like how much this opens up, it's like I would hope that takeaways from it are be like, well, how can I better manage it in the
Yeah.
future? Like being a
Absolutely.
more personal impact. Because I feel like that was, it probably took me several years before I realized like, oh no, that's actually the true lasting impact of this is like, I want to know how to manage it better. I want to know how to keep the bell jar raised so that fresh air is circulating through. I know it'll be there, but like I know I need to keep the air flowing, and if it starts to close, I need to know how to combat
That was gorgeous. Thank you.
it.
That was beautiful.
Finished reading and then immediately went into a meeting, and I could tell during the meeting that I was like, oh, I'm no one should talk to me. I should have just went straight into a podcast recording because I was like, you know, when Barbie, when she's like, do you guys ever think about dying? I was like, that was just great. I was ready for a movie just about existential crisis. I have it on a tote bag. I love it so much. It's just the person I was meeting with was like, okay. And I was like, yes, we shouldn't reveal to strangers in a one-on-one setting of like the full extent of like, what does it mean for us to be here? Anyway, instead I'll record it for people to listen to.
She puts all of this in such a tight and precise language, like a jar for lack of a better term, and gives it a little release valve, you know, to talk about it, to share it, and to know that you're not alone in it. And that's the continued resonance of it. And that I think that talking about motherhood and how like you said, your life could end up anywhere in Europe or as a mother or as both. And I think she finishes high school, she has this sort of discovery of like how mediocre she is now that there's no longer like. And she's actually not mediocre, Esther. You've got this huge job. But she's no longer got these grades. She doesn't have like markers of success. And the next reasonable, like the next step on the path is to being a mother. And you know that as a mother, you're not going to be thanked. It's not going to, you know, your success will be measured by the existence of someone else. And that journey of, like I had those lots of markers of success. I had the moment of like, well, how do I know if I'm doing good anymore? And how do I like evaluate my position? Because you want to go from A to B. And I had so many options. And so how just soul crushing would it be to have essentially zero option or one option, which is the lack of choice.
I know. It's well, it's like it's I think for I mean it's universal, but I also think for high functioning people who thrive in that like marker setting is like that transition from not having it anymore is such a jarring cliff to fall off of in the darkest comparison possible, but it's like you're free falling because I like I similarly like had the point where I was just like, well, how do I mark what my success is? And it's like I feel very fortunate that you and I are both in an era of society where we have multiple choices, like and be able to do different things. But yeah, to just have the lack of choice would be would have been a worse outcome, in my opinion, because it's just
Oh yeah.
like even having the freedom of choice. I know I personally at many points was like, am I doing what I need to do? Like, I can't
Exactly.
tell. Like, I don't know if I'm doing what I need to do. Should I like be like a like friends and from my hometown and marry and settle down and have kids, or do I keep going on this career path? And like, it almost was like I tried on that version of a life for a bit, and then now I'm on the other side of it, and it's like at the end of the day, it's comparable. Like I'm, happier in certain senses, but there's sadness in other senses, but it's in the same, there's no one amazing path for anyone. And anyone who says that they are on an amazing path without any flaws is absolutely lying through their teeth.
Oh my God, yeah. I loved how she is constantly collecting these older women who want to tell her things and how to live. And I think like she has this mixed, if I'm remembering it correctly, has this mixed reaction of like wanting the markers of success that they give, but also like not wanting the attention, not wanting the assumption of people who know things.
Or like, her perception of like Dodo Conway and like having so many kids, and she has the moment where she's like, man, I wish I just had the like mentality of like, I'll just pop out a bunch of kids kind of thing. Like, yeah, and all the people just surrounding her. It is interesting, an interesting cast of characters when you really think about who she's surrounded by. And there is a quote in there that's very funny to me that was like it was basically along the lines of I collect men, like based off of like all her experiences. And I was like, oh yeah, I understand that, of just like she has all these stories of like, yeah, I was with a transcriptionist or whatever the guy at the UN was doing kind of thing. Or then you have Buddy, who is the doctor that gets TB. Which, side note, did you have, when you were growing up, of thinking about all those like just hospitals that were built for those like crazy illnesses, and then they're just like, that's, they're never used again, like they're just left abandoned. Like, it's just wild to think about.
I don't think I did think about that a lot. I know that there were a few kids in photography class who would go to like abandoned buildings, but I don't think I ever questioned what they were.
I'm realizing as we're talking about this, I realize it's because I started watching Ghost Adventures when it came out in 2007. So it's been like a mainstay, because their first several years was like, we're at the abandoned, whatever you call it, hospital, where, oh, like sanatorium, that's it. We're at this sanatorium and it's abandoned. And like, here's all these old photos of just people with tuberculosis just hanging out. They're just sent here and they're hanging out. And I'm like, what was this world that we're just like sending people away to these far off places? And then you think about like the pandemic in the past few years, and it's like, that I feel like it would not be received well if we're like, we have these infrastructures, go over
Go over there.
there, like kind of thing. It's just like baffling. Anyway, it's all because of Ghost Adventures. It all comes back to that.
I love that. That's great. I only ever knew about tuberculosis and hospitals like that because my grandfather got tuberculosis and was in, he only had one lung afterwards. That wasn't why he got tuberculosis. But but he was in a VA hospital for a year, maybe 2 years, and he was afraid of hospitals for all his life, which is odd to me. Rectifying that with Buddy, who is just an all-around good time guy. He's really like Joe Schmo, Joe America. He's but like you said, there are these like really sharp characters, and he's one of the most outstanding.
Yeah, it's so funny that he's like, I'm falling in love with this TV nurse, but like, if we hang out over the summer, I'm maybe able to fall back in love with you. And it's just like such an acerbic takedown of the people around her, and like the class perception from this, pseudo character of Esther, of like around people and like people's proclivities, and like just exposing it in a way that you're like, oh yeah, there are people in the world that just observe in that manner and can like really remind you of like, this is something you do kind of thing. Yeah, the skiing scene, like stuff is just popping in my brain now, but like the skiing of Buddy doesn't know how to ski. She doesn't know how to ski, but he's like, I've seen enough people do it. I'll teach you. How would you go up to that? And again, not to keep
Classic.
referring to just learning how to ski, but like, that would be, I almost did that, where I just didn't take a lesson and the person I was with was going to just show me how to ski. And I was like, ah, that seems like a bad idea. And then reading it in the book, and I was like, yeah, it seems like a bad idea.
I went on a few ski trips growing up, and it was something that never made any sense. And then I tried snowboarding like twice. Oh my, I can't express how little I did this, but I preferred snowboarding. Maybe it's also just like that the so many long sticks and stuff. It whatever. I love the aesthetic, the feeling, the mental image of a ski lodge. It's my happy place
Yeah,
in
roaring fires, furs.
there.
Sorry, you're gonna activate the bit side of me where I'm just gonna keep
No,
going.
good, good. I was really astonished, and it didn't occur to me later on, but the lack of transitions of especially when she's in the hospital, especially when she's going under ECT and insulin treatment, she'll just end a paragraph and then start a new paragraph in a completely different time in a completely different setting.
Yeah.
You'll have like no sense of how much time has passed. And by the end, when she's going in and out of consciousness so much, I think is when I realized it, that it was happening, or at least that it took up a lot of my attention.
It's funny you say that. There is like a very interesting way she does stuff of like she starts in a situation and then she refers back to something, but there's not like a distinct throwback to whatever she's referring to. And the most prominent one is when she's on the beach with her friend and the two guys, and she goes out and is swimming, you know, and they're like start to swim, and then it's like paragraph break, and then it's like I tried to hang myself this morning.
Yes.
And she just like goes into how she tried it and she couldn't tie the knot right, and then it was loose on her neck, and every time she just tried to pull it herself because she couldn't find a strong enough place to hang it, that like her body kept doing its fail safes to stop herself. And yeah, so that was what she did that morning. And then paragraph break. And then it's like, I'm swimming in the ocean.
Yeah.
And Cal was like, I need to go back. And I'm like, I could, this is okay. I didn't successfully do the hanging, but I'll do it now. So it's just interesting if like the brief breaks back into something else. She does it at a different point earlier in the book in her New York days, but it's not as like distinct of a, I mean, it's harder to get more distinct than prominently saying or tried killing yourself that morning, but.
Yeah. And then to go back to, well, I'm still swimming in the ocean.
Yeah,
Yeah.
it's just like, oh yeah,
Absolutely.
divert back to that real quick. Let's see. 4th of July rocket. Let's find what that quote was, because that was, oh, she says, that's one of the reasons I never wanted to get married. The last thing I wanted was infinite security and to be the place an arrow shoots off from. I wanted change and excitement and to shoot off in all directions myself, like the colored arrows from a 4th of July rocket.
That's so good.
I know.
It's 1963, like that it's published and it's set in 1953. I mean, this is the year 1963 is the year that JFK signs the Equal Pay Act.
Yeah, it's wild
It's
to
just
think of the
wild.
context of it.
Yeah.
It's like just so timeless in majority of it, of like the
Yeah.
feelings. I mean, you know, the stuff that is not correct for today's world aside, but
Yeah.
everything else is like majority of the universal experience within this. I'm trying to, why
Definitely.
did I write this one?
There's even the, I mean, in the final chapters, she goes to get a diaphragm and says that it's illegal to just get a diaphragm in Massachusetts in 53, which was, I forgot that there was a scene with her getting a diaphragm. And now in the context of 63, that's wild. And of course, wasn't published here until 71. But I'm editing our episode on the care and keeping of you. And so that it's crazy you read a book about a diaphragm in high school. It's not about a diaphragm, but
She like fully hemorrhages from
yes.
a two, and that's like when I was reading it this time, I was like, another moment that I was like, oh, I forgot entirely that this happens. But the doctor says that ominous thing of like, oh, I can fix it, and I was like,
Yes.
did I forget that she's like genitally mutilated in this, like, or like, is she? And then it just wasn't referred to, so I was like, okay, maybe it's just the sexism of like he's mad that he has to fix someone who clearly had sex before marriage. But I was just like, it's such a big moment right at the end, and it's just not further explained of like,
Yeah.
because then it goes into Joan's death like almost immediately after.
Right. Which Joan was an interesting character as Bette Williams' other girl, and also as like the alternate, like the shadow of Esther when she's in the asylum.
Yeah.
That line of I can fix this or
And she implies that there's such a tone that he says it with as well.
Yeah, I still don't know if I know what that means. She's hemorrhaging. I think I, on the face of it, just read it as like, I can fix the hemorrhaging. But I don't know. There's like, comparing that with the Karen Keeping a View, it's so much of that, like what people tell you versus what they don't about your first time, and about my guest in that episode described, you know, puberty is like 5 years of constant body horror. And I think that what a like a book not written to be a horror or anything, but so scary in the
Yeah.
end, this book.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, it is interesting. I mean, I could go on another diatribe of just how horror like is such a perfect avenue in certain ways to depict so many things. I think I've told you before to watch Birth Rebirth. It's like, I mean, that's body horror, and but it's an incredible feminist depiction of the motherhood and having to deal with that. But yeah, it's like, but that sets out to be a horror. Oh, the dialogue between Buddy and her of she so Esther says, "Remember how you asked me where I like to live best, the country or the city, Buddy?" And you said, "Esther," and I said, "I wanted to live in the country and in the city both." Buddy nodded. And you, I continued with a sudden force, laughed and said I had the perfect setup of a true neurotic, that the question came from some questionnaire you'd had in psychology class that week. Buddy's smile dimmed. "Well, you were right. I am neurotic. I could never settle down in either the country or the city." I just thought that was so funny, of just like, that's like what's like, and yeah, I guess that's fair. And then let's say this last. Oh, I think this was like one of the just other moments of like impact on me of reading it at age 15, was it's like when she's trying to write the novel and she writes just like a few pages or whatever. And so like she writes the section that's like, "Inertia oozed like molasses through Elaine's limbs. That's what it must feel like to have malaria," she thought. And she cuts back and she's like, "At that rate, I'd be lucky if I wrote a page a day. Then I knew what the trouble was. I needed experience. How could I write about life when I never had a love affair or a baby or even seen anybody die? A girl I knew had just won a prize for a short story about her adventures among the pygmies in Africa. How could I compete with that sort of thing?" Like, and so I remember reading that and being like, because, you know, my background is, you know, being from Arizona and then knowing from an early age that I wanted to go and live somewhere else. And then like really pushing myself to do that at 18. And living in a completely different way, because I was just like, I want experience. And then I remember reading that and being like, yeah, how can you like be a creative without experiencing life? And I come back to that question all the time, every few years when I take assessment of my own life, of being like, and this is a question I asked myself in the recent years, was like, I had a moment where I realized it's like all my stories and anecdotes come from when I lived in New York and Chicago. I don't know if I have really any good anecdotal stories in LA, and I'm like, well, now am I like actually experiencing it? Am I like actually living an experience, or am I just going through the day? So I think it's just like something to always be thinking of in a certain way to make sure that it's not getting caught up in the mundanity.
That's something to ruminate on, because I'm trying to think, and I think that's true for me as well. But I'm also thinking how many of my anecdotes are just like, we did this weird shit in high school. Maybe that's something, a specific phase I'm going through.
I just get so caught up on storytelling in general, of like, you know, aside from that being my job is to, you know, work through story and all of that, it's also like when my own personal creativity of like, well, what do I want to draw upon for my own personal creativity or essay writing or something like that? And it's just like, man, that thing that I think I want to write about happened 10 years ago. Has anything newer happened since that I have like kind of a fresher memory on? No? Okay, well, I guess I should put myself in more positions for experience. So, yeah, that's another moment of like, yeah, probably at 15, reading that impacted and influenced the way that I like approached life past that point of reading it.
While I started reading this, I was reading My Year of Rest and Relaxation by Ottessa Moshfeghi. Have you read it?
I have read it. I read it a year ago when I was going through a very difficult time. And so it was a very interesting choice. And I don't know why I keep subconsciously pulling in books at like not diff or like necessarily always difficult, but at very transitional times, I will say. So I read that and I like it is so intense. And like, I love Otessa's writing as well. And I'm sure there's probably some indication of influence from like Plath's writing at some point.
Absolutely. I felt a lot of, it didn't come up as much in Plath directly, but in my Urine Rest of Relaxation, there's this idea of like, I just need to rest long enough to be a new person and new and then able to go out into the world. And there felt like, even if it again wasn't explicit, so much of that felt present in the bell jar. They're really interesting companions to each other.
It is. It's. I saw you post about that you're reading that, and I was like, oh yeah, having freshly read that, freshly being just a year, is just like, yeah, that is. They are intriguing companions to have, because it's just like this, yeah, this journey of like, well, if I just do this one thing, I'll finally feel normal,
Yeah.
and that normalcy is never on the other side of that journey. It's just the reality of the human experience at the end of the day.
Yeah. I think my only other note is just like a few hours ago, I realized why it did not stick in my brain the first time I read it. And I
Interesting.
wouldn't have realized it if I didn't use, I used to use Goodreads, but now I use Storygraph. And I went on there and it had the exact date I finished it. And I finished reading it when I was 19. And it was during my first relationship, which only lasted 2 months. It was a very narrow window. And so I realized like I was out of my mind with like being in love for the first time chemicals and just not paying attention at all to this. And I realized if I read it when I was 16, it would have been my entire world. I like when I was 15 over that summer, I spent a month living in New York, taking like high school classes at NYU, and it was my entire personality after that. I lost friends because they were annoyed with how much I talked about it. And then I entered like the worst depression I've ever experienced coming back from that. And so this would have just wrecked me. It's a thing of like sometimes with these books, I like wish they had hit me at a certain time, and this is a more of a thing of like maybe not the best time, but a better time for me to have read this. But I'm so glad I revisited it. I think that's my last note, other than the end being a little surprise. Like the end was surprisingly hopeful, which reminded me of I last year read Shirley Jackson's Hang as a Man, which inspired the Josephine Decker film of Shirley with Elizabeth Moss in it, which is a phenomenal film if you have not seen it. And that book is a thriller, is horror about a girl, I think her freshman year at college, that also had a surprisingly hopeful ending. And I think also maybe just an interesting pairing with this as well. But it almost felt wrong. And like you said earlier, paired with knowing her death, it feels false. Yeah.
I can't. It's like a block in my brain of like something else that I read a script one time about Marilyn Monroe, and it was like kind of around the last days. And the way I just remember the feeling of reading of the ending feeling hopeful, but you're like, you know what happens. Like just those moments of reading something and being like, well, you know what happens like immediately after. And that was like another one of these moments. And I also thought it was interesting when I was doing that random little Google search and like the questions that came up, and I was like clicking through all the drop downs, and one of them was like, what's the last line of the book? And it was saying it was the I am, I am, I am. And I was like, that's incorrect. It's not. It is not that. It is the whole her being evaluated by the doctors. Like, and her, the true last line of it is the eyes and the faces all turned themselves toward me, and guiding myself by them, by as by a magical thread, I stepped into the room. And so that's where it's the more hopeful. Where it's like, I'm curious of like, if you did just end on the I am, I am, I am, it's like, okay, that's like kind of a middle of the road thing. But then like,
It's such a good ending where it is. It's such a good ending. It like it makes you take a sharp little inhale when you read it.
because you just like don't know if it actually like how it'll actually pan out. I mean, like you, the reality besides the auto fiction nature of it is like you hope that it would be a better outcome for her,
So, how does it feel having come off
but
reading it again?
it's like I'm really happy to revisit it in a like a weird way of just like it's almost like a good marking of personal growth for myself of like thinking back to 'cause like also to read it in a time where I'm in such a reflective mode, about turning a new decade and taking stock of my life and then revisiting something that felt so impactful, like as a teen, and felt like it probably ended up morphing me so much. And like, it was definitely, it's like I'm really happy to revisit it. And it's like something I've thought about rereading for a very long time. And I was very glad to like sit down and read it. And I'm glad I finished it before we recorded as well, because I would have had a more inauthentic conversation about it had I not made myself actually finish it and just spark notes it like a true high school experience. But no, yeah, I'm really glad to, and it's one that's like I think more people should read it, and I think like it shouldn't just be like reading it as a teen. I think like adults should read it as well. I talked to a few people who had never read it when I was mentioning that I was reading it, and I was like, I think you should read it. I think it's very
Yeah.
interesting.
So you would consider it required reading?
I would consider it required reading.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. Me too. I mean, it's even with nothing else, it is very, very just well written
It is,
literature.
yes. It shows that like you don't need to be a 500 page book to like create impact. Is my
Absolutely.
I love the under 250 page books, because it's like it's almost like you're in, you're out. It's like how I like a lot of my movies. It's like
Yeah.
let's have a tight runtime,
Exactly.
fellas. But yeah, no, it is, it's definitely required.
That was the great It was the greatest praise I got from a professor in my short time at NYU. He went, "That's a tight little play." It
That was,
felt
I
very
had something
good.
similar of like, I made all my short films like under 6 minutes, and everyone's like, oh great, it's a short film, and I was like, yeah, it's
Yep, that's
in
all I got.
the name.
I love that. And that's all I got for
Great,
this.
what a good natural ending.
Is there anything you want to plug?
Nope.
All good.
I got nothing at the moment. I really don't have anything at the moment. This is what happens when you get behind the scenes too long, and then you're like, well, nothing at the moment, but at some point down the line, sure.
Thank you so much for doing this.
Of course.
Thank you so much for coming on, Zoe. We had a wonderful time revisiting this book. Such a treat. And we mentioned in this episode, Zoe's 30th birthday was coming up. Her party was fantastic, just so you know. Next week, it's a thick one. Start reading now. We're doing Grapes of Wrath. And I know that the episodes are coming out like once every 2 weeks. But that's okay. Maybe it means I'm busy, okay? I booked a role. I booked a role for the first time in 2 years. What is it? Shut up. I'll see you then. You can find me everywhere at Erin R. Bowles. R as in rejoicing. Well, that's a really good one, huh? Okay, bye.